This is Audible.
Leadership, The Art of Inspiring People to Be Their Best. Written by Major General Craig B. Walton. U.S. Army, retired. Narrated by Jack Aries.
Titles, headings, and female dialogue performed by Tanis Clark. Dedication.
Dedicated to my dad, who inspired me at an early age to climb my own mountain and to be my best. First Lieutenant George T. Weldon, Jr., 1944. What the Marine Corps taught me can be seen every day in FedEx. Frederick W. Smith, Chairman and CEO, FedEx Corporation.
Forward. What now, Lieutenant?
More than 50 years ago, while studying to be an Army officer, our class had a series of films to watch, titled, What Now, Lieutenant? Each short film would present a scenario, during which the young and inexperienced lieutenant would face a challenge, a crisis of command, in which his soldiers would literally look to him for resolution. The instructor would stop the projector, remember this was 50 years ago, and then ask for the answer. We would occasionally get it right, but we always got the lesson that good leaders must make good decisions for good reasons. I can still recall the exact details of the particular episode that stuck with me throughout my career. I think it was my first brush with learning about leadership. I have known Craig Weldon for more than 20 years and have watched him in action as an Army general officer and as a senior executive for the Marine Corps. As I read his book, I was reminded again of how much one can learn about leadership through watching others grapple with the demands of leadership and how each of them acts, makes decisions, and does not shy from accountability. We learn most from successful leaders because we see what works and why. Craig is one such leader. And his ability to share his experiences, some of which are intensely personal, and articulate what he has learned, enriches the reader. The chapters are short, with intriguing titles. They contain several vignettes from his life with pertinent leadership examples and lessons. He is very clear in explaining each challenge, and he is equally straightforward in explaining his solution. You'll gain a valuable perspective on style and substance through his experiences. He is not pedantic. He is conversational. You will come away with guidelines and principles that mark a leader who others want to follow. Craig provides compelling examples of leading units through change and turbulence. In fact, his leadership journey is also a biography of the American Army and one of its most transformative periods, 1973 to 2003. The exact 30 years Craig went from second lieutenant to major general. He saw the agonizing recovery from the Vietnam War, the elimination of the draft, the training revolution, the success of the volunteer force, the rise of the joint force, and the nation again at war. Those who served during that period will find themselves remembering the many challenges that surfaced as the Army and the nation regained its footing after Vietnam. We owe Craig and his generation of officers our profound gratitude for what they accomplished in leading the Army from turbulence to triumph. Yes, this is a book about successful leadership in a military environment, but in virtually every vignette, one can extrapolate the essence and apply lessons to the corporate world, the not-for-profit world, or even the arena of leading volunteers. There's a lot here for every leader, neophyte or experienced. I suggest those serving or who have served will find themselves very easily in the book, and each may be able to compare their leadership experience to how Craig approached the challenge. For me, the chapters on character, loyalty, virtual mentorship, ethics, memento mori, and hope, the light at the end of the tunnel, especially resonated. No surprise, chapter 1 is about character. We know it's the prerequisite for all effective leaders. Craig points out that loyalty is both a process and an investment. You'll be surprised when you read the key to his getting the Senior Executive Service, SES, position with the Marine Corps, despite the odds. I have often argued for the underappreciated value of the role model in leader development, but Craig elevates it properly in his unique take on virtual mentorship. With his 4 categories of mentors, I would have every senior executive, military, and civilian read Memento Mori, both for the examples and the lessons. As I mentioned, Craig does not blanch when addressing the challenge of leading in the midst of personal setback and profound tragedy. He answers here by burying his life and showing how a leader retains equilibrium while leading others, realizing there is a light, elusive in the moment, but still there at the end of the tunnel. Craig brings the cliché to life. Every reader will find their own special chapters, as I did. If you want an executive summary, read Appendix A, Weldon Philosophy of Command. He was, and is, as good as his words. I know as I've watched and admired him as a leader, husband, and father. Now here's a leadership vignette Craig did not provide. This past November, my wife and I attended the annual Marine Corps birthday ball. Also in attendance were Marine Corps senior leaders, including Craig. After dinner, when the informal camaraderie took hold, groups of Marines gathered for photos. One large group of Marines, of all ranks, gathered in front of the large American flag, and they called for one man to join them. They had a choice of many senior Marines, but they chose Craig. There he stood, with the Marines, unique in his civilian clothes, and the one they chose. Here was a leader who had gained their respect, admiration, and affection. For 39 years, Craig has been the leader others want to follow. This book will surely add to the legacy of leadership he has left through his impact on others by inspiring them and those who follow to be their best. Signed, David A. Bramlett, General, U.S. Army, retired, former commander, U.S. Army Forces Command.
Prologue.
Webster defines leadership as, quote, the act or an instance of leading, unquote. If there's one profession where strong and effective leadership is absolutely required, it is the military. Exceptional corporate leadership is, of course, also a necessity, focused on maximizing profits, producing high-quality products, and keeping a company sustainable. Leadership in government, too, is critical, moving society forward and guiding the ongoing process of democracy. But military leadership is different. It is about ensuring a nation's survival, preventing its decline, or, worst case, its demise. It is about life and death. I spent most of my life in or around the military. I was an Air Force family member growing up, then had a 30-year career as an Army officer, and another 9 years as a member of the federal government's Senior Executive Service, SES, with the Marine Corps. Combined, I spent 16 years as either an Army general officer or a Marine Corps senior executive, providing ample opportunity to develop my own leadership skills. Over the course of the past many decades, I worked for some brilliant and highly effective leaders and learned a great deal about what made them tick. I saw how they inspired people to be their best, and I hope to have picked up some of their habits. I've also worked for some not-so-great leaders, and have learned from them as well. What not to do. My purpose in writing this book is to pay forward those lessons, both good and bad. I entitled the book Leadership, The Art of Inspiring People to Be Their Best, because I believe this is precisely the key to great leadership, helping people perform at their best. My 5 decades of experience should be relevant and helpful to leaders and aspiring leaders in any profession, as well as in their personal lives. You will also find this book an interesting and fun read because I move beyond the dryness and banality of academic theory, citing personal examples about what has worked for me and what has not. As they say in Hawaii, we are going to talk story. Before delving into the main part of the book, let me state the obvious. Leading is complicated. Many tangible and intangible qualities are found in both leaders and those being led that, when combined, contribute to the overall effectiveness of a good leader. Getting people to follow you is a function of inspiring the loyalty of those being led and understanding what expectations they have of the type of leader they are willing to follow. In effect, there is a mutual dependence in the relationship, forged through trust, shared values, and mutually desired goals. It is as much art as science. Hence the subtitle of this book, The Art of Inspiring People to Be Their Best. Many may think that the military relies on a disciplined set of rules to have effective leaders, but make that the first lesson of this book. While the military does instill strict rules and regulations on its uniformed members, the tenets of strong leadership are not built on that foundation alone. Members of the military are neither robots nor automatons. They are living, feeling human beings, just like corporate employees or members of any organization. They pay taxes, raise families, and live in our communities. They have both personal and professional issues that need attending to. Paying attention to their emotional, psychological, and spiritual needs, along with their professional development, is critical if you want them to willingly and unfailingly follow you. In the course of this book, you will learn much about my approach to leadership and about me. I hope the lessons I have carved out from the past 50 years will help you improve your leadership skills and inspire you to be the best you can be in whatever you do. Not every chapter includes a leadership lesson, though most do. Some chapters have very clear lessons. Others are subtle, and some are just a fun ride. Agree or disagree. Keep what you want, and disregard what you've already mastered or what isn't a good personal fit for you. It's all free, after you purchase the audiobook. Finally, I hope that you will pay forward to others whatever you think is worthy.
Signed, Major General Craig B. Weldon, U.S. Army, retired.
Chapter 1. Character. Leadership's basic building block.
Talent is God-given. Be humble. Fame is man-given. Be grateful. Conceit is self-given. Be careful. John Wooden. There has been a long-running debate about whether great leaders are born that way or are developed through experience, education, and training. I suggest that both are required. No one doubts that the very best leaders have both innate and developed skills, built upon through education and experience. But the greatest talents and experts do not always make great leaders. A critical and foundational element of the very best leaders is character, with qualities like ambition, perseverance, self-awareness, empathy, humility, integrity, and always taking seriously the responsibility of being a leader, often while sacrificing their own personal welfare or gain.
Character is part nature, part nurture. It obviously helps to be born with the right genetic makeup that predisposes you to be a great leader. However, I've seen too many people who thought they were born leaders, while nature didn't agree. They didn't nurture what little they had to fill the gaps. They lacked the qualities just cited, and seemed to operate solely on raw instinct. Some led by commanding others loudly, harshly, and aggressively. They may have believed the only way to get results was with an iron fist. Others I've known have taken advantage of their position of power, imposing their will through brute and harmful practices. In recent years, the hashtag MeToo movement has brought this type of behavior into the national consciousness and provided support to brave survivors. True leaders do not take advantage of their employees in this way. I've also seen people who were born into tremendous adversity and had little leadership training, yet they nurtured their best qualities and became leaders who can attract followers as few others can. Combining innate skills with world-class training quite often produces great results. The U.S. military seeks the former and provides the latter. The result has been tested in some of the most difficult circumstances throughout our nation's history, and has produced a stable of exceptional leaders when our nation needed them most. Let me delve more into the qualities of character I think leaders need to have, and how nature can be nurtured to produce the best of breed. Even if you don't consider yourself a born leader, effective training and experience can produce great results. Leadership can be taught, as long as there are basic building blocks already there.
Ambition and perseverance.
Behind every great leader are these two strong character traits. Ambition is what drives them to excel, to have a vision of better results, and to strive for personal excellence in everything they do. Perseverance is what keeps them going anytime they encounter an obstacle or challenge that seems like it will block forward progress. Some call this grit. These qualities were first instilled to me in my dad. He too was in the military, and his story is worth sharing. George Weldon was a sophomore at Purdue University in 1941. On December 7th of that year, a lazy Sunday afternoon, he was walking up the stairs of his fraternity trying to decide whether to study or go see a movie when he overheard from a nearby room a radio report of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The very next day, he and most of his fraternity brothers went to the recruiting office to sign up. But overwhelmed by the sheer volume of volunteers, the recruiters told them to go back to school and wait until called, as there wasn't enough capacity to train the millions who wanted to enlist. When he was finally called several months later, he ended up in flight school in Texas, followed by a posting to India, where he flew C-47s. And to Kunming, China, in support of Chenault's Flying Tigers. After the war, my dad returned to the U.S. to resume his education at Indiana University's law school. In 1948, he married my mother, Mary Joanne Beckett. A year later, my brother was born, and in 1951, I followed. Just months before my father was to take the bar exam, the Korean War broke out. He was recalled to active duty and sent to Fort Benning to support the Army's Airborne School, a school I attended 20 years later. From that initial assignment, and now with a wife and two kids in tow, he decided to stay in the Air Force after the Korean War, and for the next 20 years, my family traveled all over the world. Georgia, Oklahoma, Colorado, England, New Mexico, Alabama, Louisiana, Paris, France, and finally, Casto, Belgium. At Bossier Air Force Base, near Shreveport, Louisiana, he worked for a man who was incorrigible. Not only did he have him as his boss for the entire 3 years we were there, but this man was also our next-door neighbor. Their personalities were like oil and water, and it was a low point for my dad because there was no escape. Through it all, he persevered. He had grit. Fortunately, a former mentor from our time in England reached out to help facilitate his next assignment to Paris, France, where my dad joined the Supreme Headquarters for Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE. the military arm of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. A year later, President Charles de Gaulle pulled France out of NATO, and we left Paris on short notice. Southern Belgium became our new home, and it was where I spent my last 2 years of high school. My dad retired from the Air Force, just as I was starting college in the early 70s. He returned to law school, but it had been such a long time since he was a law student that he had to start over. He was given credit for only one course, Introduction to Law. With classes at night and a day job as a county clerk, he still managed to graduate cum laude in just a few years, and he eventually became a judge for the state of Indiana. Becoming a lawyer was something my dad wanted as long as I can remember. Watching him persevere through those hard times in Louisiana, and watching his laser focus on this ultimate goal, I was inspired at an early age to climb my own mountain, to be the best I can be.
Self-awareness.
I suggest that great leaders also possess a subtle quality called self-awareness. In today's parlance, they have a high degree of mindfulness. They can examine their thoughts and actions and almost intuitively recognize when they are on the right path or the wrong one. They know themselves well and are sensitive and cognizant of how others view them. My own self-awareness started to take shape when I attended the Army's Ranger School in 1973. This superb training and leadership school used peer reviews to help weed out candidates who are not good team players. We were required to rate each other on many qualities, which is a surefire way to become self-aware. I next encountered a similar peer review technique only when I became a general officer 23 years later. It was incorporated into an annual questionnaire that asked three questions about every officer of the same rank. Do you know this officer? If yes, do you recommend this officer for promotion? If yes, do you recommend this officer for command? I dutifully filled out the questionnaire every year and forwarded it back to the source, where it presumably was folded into an algorithm and provided to the chief of staff of the Army, who used it to help him select his general officers for assignments and command. The only other instance of such an introspective review for me started in 2010, when I became a member of the federal government's senior executive service, a position I held for more than 9 years. Every 3 years, we were required to take a 360-degree evaluation, which solicits input from our boss, our contemporaries, and our subordinates. All, except the boss, done anonymously. The evaluation was extensive, asking many questions and leaving room for comments. It also asked that we rate ourselves, so we could see how our view compared to how others see us. It is important for leaders to be self-aware, while equally appreciating how they are viewed by others based on job knowledge, dedication to the team, empathy, optimism, character, humility, trust, approachability, and confidence. When combined, and if all these traits are positive, they inspire others. Exceptional leaders have the ability to motivate in a way that many others cannot. It's an intangible quality that raises the probability of their success because people actually want to do well for them. An obvious byproduct is that it is also good for the organization as the organization becomes more productive. I once worked for a 3-star general who was exceptionally smart, extremely competent, and the consummate gentleman. He never raised his voice in anger. One day, a colonel on our staff told me that the general was the toughest boss he had ever worked for. Perplexed, I asked him why. He replied, "Because I never wanted to disappoint him." I knew exactly what he meant.
A positive attitude.
Having a positive attitude is a critical element of leadership. To some, this comes naturally. Others must constantly work on it. Since my earliest memory, I have had the sense that anything worth doing, worth pursuing, must be passionately pursued. A positive attitude naturally follows. I found myself first assuming leadership responsibilities at age 14, when I became an Eagle Scout, Perhaps I was naive, but the leadership aspect of this achievement was unexpected. For me, getting there was just a mountain to climb. It was the culmination of 21 merit badges and a large community project. It was the excitement of the journey, the arrival at a destination, and the achievement of the reward. For me, at 14 years old, it was like reaching the top of Mount Everest, but with no real thoughts or plan on how I was going to get back down, the part of the climb where most people die. Once there, I didn't quite know what to do with these newfound responsibilities when people started turning to me to lead. But it did help jumpstart a lifelong journey to develop and sharpen my leadership skills. A journey that really never ends. Great leaders constantly deal with the struggle between achieving personal goals, while doing so with humility. Ask yourself, do you want to achieve lofty goals in order to climb the mountain? Or do you want to get on top of the mountain so that you can help others climb their own mountain? How can you do both? In high school, I held leadership roles in school government and on the sports field. In my senior year, I was voted best all around and most dependable, the latter accolade drawing raised eyebrows from my parents. At Purdue University, I was president of the freshman council at the largest school dormitory, president of my fraternity pledge class, and vice president of Purdue's interfraternity council. I ran for president, but was asked by the council whether I would take the VP spot if not selected to be president. My agreement sealed my fate. All these experiences helped shape my thinking about and commitment to leadership because people started to turn to me to lead. I had the right attitude throughout these early years. However, there came a period in college when I lost my way. My attendance at Purdue was facilitated by an Army ROTC scholarship. At a time when the Vietnam War was stoking nationwide protests across nearly every college campus. Compared to other campuses, Purdue was a fairly conservative school. But we had a chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, and they regularly protested the war on the mall or at the armory. I had mixed feelings about the war when I arrived at Purdue in 1969, having spent most of my high school years in Europe, insulated from the anti-war movement. But since I had an ROTC scholarship and my dad was retiring from the Air Force and starting law school about the same time I entered college, I felt an obligation to stay in a program that was paying my way. I also worked 4 hours each evening, Monday through Friday, as a janitor, cleaning the second floor of the university library to help make ends meet. Then an unfortunate event happened. Because of my student government activities, my leadership role in the fraternity and my work schedule, combined with ambivalence about the war, I didn't participate in any ROTC activities outside the classroom. Just walking across campus in uniform to attend military drills drew unwanted attention. So when the annual Army ROTC Awards ceremony occurred in the spring of my freshman year, 1970, and knowing that I was not an award recipient, I decided to skip the ceremony and attend the SDS rally in the mall instead. Not my brightest moment. That day, after chanting, 1, 2, 3, 4. We don't want your effing war. Over and over again, a growing crowd of about 1,000 decided to march on the armory, where the ROTC award ceremony had been moved to insulate it from the protests. I followed the crowd. Upon arriving at the armory, they broke open the large truck-sized doors and entered, chanting loud and strong. State troopers in riot gear soon arrived to keep the protesters away from the formation of cadets. I was not an active protest participant, and naively thought of myself as being in some kind of intellectual exercise. But one of my instructors saw me that day. He called me in the following morning and told me that my scholarship was being put on probation. This was a wake-up call for me. and it began the reshaping of my attitude. I had to decide which side to be on. I came to realize that I wanted to be a leader more than a protester. Like some other Americans, I may have thought that the Vietnam War was ill-advised, but I also realized that there were alternative ways to make my mark on the world. When ROTC summer camp training rolled around between my junior and senior year, I spent 9 weeks at Fort Riley and did well enough to become the third-ranking cadet at Purdue during my senior year. Upon graduation from Purdue in 1973, I was one of 6 cadets designated a distinguished military graduate. So, what should you take from this ROTC experience? In a nutshell, attitude counts. A lot. There's something to be said about the oft-repeated mantra that you can be whatever you want to be. That said, all aspects of character mentioned at the beginning of this chapter are required if you're to be the best you can be. You need building blocks to realize that dream. During those early years at Purdue, at least as it applied to any Army career, I lacked ambition, a good self-awareness, and perseverance. I lacked grit. I simply knew that I owed 4 years to the Army after graduation because of my scholarship. But after that, I thought I could move on to something else. Once I finally decided to get on board, my ambition, perseverance, and self-awareness kicked into high gear. I then adjusted my attitude, and a 4-year commitment turned into a 30-year career.
Chapter 2. Trusting Your People.
Few things help an individual more than to place responsibility upon him and to let him know that you trust him. Booker T. Washington.
In the first 3 years of my Army career, I was stationed at Fort Hood, Texas. When my time there was to end, I was a first lieutenant, getting ready for my next assignment. I called my assignment officer in Washington, D.C. to inquire about what was next. Major Tom Montgomery answered the phone, and he seemed to be in a bad mood. The first thing he said was how upset he was that Purdue had just bested Indiana University in the old Oaken Bucket football game, the premier rivalry in the state of Indiana, the previous weekend. How did he know I was a graduate of Purdue, and why would he be so concerned about a football game?
As it turned out, he was a graduate of Indiana and was just having some fun, at my expense, the beginning of banter between us that continues to this day.
After we got past this uncomfortable opening moment, for me at least, he confirmed that I was being assigned to Germany after I attended the Armor Officers Advanced Course at Fort Knox. Then he casually suggested that, on my way to Germany, I should consider passing through Washington, D.C. I asked if I could bring a friend, and he readily agreed. My friend was Bob Westholm. He and I had been in the Armor Officer Basic Course together in 1973 and were placed on the same tank for training, since assignments were made alphabetically. Westholm, Weldon, Williams, and Williams. Bob and I were then coincidentally sent to the same tank battalion at Fort Hood, Texas. And now, 3 years later, we would both be attending the advanced course at Fort Knox. We roomed together in a bachelor pad in Louisville and were then assigned to be in the same unit in Erlangen, Germany, after the course. We had become great friends and colleagues. So, following the advanced course, Bob and I took up Major Montgomery's offer. Stopping to consult your career manager was encouraged by Armor Branch, as it was an opportunity to have face-to-face counseling on your career and assignments. After discussing our respective career paths, he took us to dinner at a restaurant on the top floor of a hotel overlooking the nation's capital. Eerily, this was the same hotel that I was at on 9/11 while attending an Army conference 24 years later, a story I share in Chapter 16. At that time, Tom Montgomery was also a senior White House military social, protocol, aide to the President of the United States. This meeting with him in 1977 started a relationship that lasts to this day. He is close enough to my family that my son's middle name is Thomas. I later became his operations officer when he was commanding a brigade as a colonel. During his time in Somalia in 1992, Tom was a 2-star general and the deputy United Nations force commander under a 3-star Turkish general. He also wore a second hat, commander of U.S. forces, that made him responsible for the performance and safety of U.S. troops assigned there. Somalia was a humanitarian disaster, with tens of thousands of civilians starving to death. It was a political morass in the aftermath of a violent civil war. Clan warfare was stalling the humanitarian effort, and the UN decided to intervene to ensure that relief could get to the people. Later, the mission became one of nation building. The United States joined the humanitarian effort with the best of intentions under President Bush, and then supported the expanded mission to bring peace between opposing warlords and rebuild political institutions supported by the new Clinton administration. But we quickly found the UN force challenged militarily beyond the means to respond in kind. Because the mission was primarily designed to be a humanitarian assistance effort, and the level of violence had been underestimated, U.S. forces were lightly armed and unprepared for any type of significant conflict. Montgomery realized there was a need for added combat power to protect the force, and in August, he sent a request to General Joseph Hoar, the Central Command commander, his immediate U.S. boss, for tanks and armored vehicles, quote, at the earliest possible date, unquote. He added, I believe that U.S. forces are at risk without it. He asked for 28 M1 Abrams tanks and 28 Bradley fighting vehicles. Hoar's initial reaction to that request during a face-to-face meeting in Mogadishu was, this isn't going to fly politically, Tom. Montgomery replied, yes, sir, but it's what I need. Hoar directed him to reduce the size of the requested force, and Montgomery resubmitted a new request on September 14th. Hoar passed the reduced request to the Pentagon on the 23rd September, but Defense Secretary Les Aspin turned it down. 10 days later, on October 3rd, 18 Americans were killed in a battle that is now widely known as Black Hawk Down. Montgomery had to scramble to borrow some lightly armored UN Malaysian vehicles and 4 old Pakistani tanks to add to his heroic foot-bound infantry battalion, 2nd Battalion, 14th Infantry, from the 10th Mountain Division. That joint force, commanded by a great battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Bill David, fought all night and took additional casualties, including Malaysians and Pakistanis, before finally reaching and rescuing surrounded Rangers. Aspin subsequently accepted responsibility for disapproving Montgomery's request and resigned. Almost exactly 20 years later, a similar situation played out in Benghazi, Libya, where we lost Ambassador Chris Stevens and Sean Smith, as well as Tyrone Woods and Glenn Dougherty, CIA security contractors who responded to the initial attack. At least 10 congressional investigations followed. But what now seems clear is that requests for additional security prior to the attack were denied by State Department officials. Ultimately, several senior State Department officials resigned, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton accepted responsibility for the security lapses. Lessons from these sad episodes are self-evident. Military commanders must always tell their civilian bosses and the political leadership what they need to get the job done, without trying to judge what might ultimately be politically acceptable. Let the civilian and political leadership make that call. Both of these episodes drew tactical and operational level lessons, but had strategic implications. A commander must always give his boss his best military advice. And yes, if you put a commander in charge,
you should support him, or relieve him if you think he's wrong-minded about the mission. Military professionals make the case and then do the best job possible with what they are given. Regrettably, and too often, politics does trump military strategy, and the results are all too familiar. We've learned this lesson, and repeated it far too many times.
Some personal experiences with trust.
If you believe everything depends on you to ensure it is done properly, then you're in for a rough road ahead. It can be hard to relinquish control, but leaders need to delegate. And to do that, you need to trust those below you, and the people below them, and then the folks below them. There's no question that an organization's strength and output is only as good as the people in it. But demonstrating trust, and then allowing people to do their job, should be the goal of every new leader. People often perform at their highest level if they know they are trusted. The great writer Ernest Hemingway put it this way, in his inimitable style: "The best way to find out if you can trust somebody is to trust them." I've often told people in new organizations I joined that I trust them until that trust is violated. This puts a healthy kind of pressure on them not to violate that trust. Stronger performance is often the result. That is why I say that the job of a leader is to inspire people to be their best. They will often deliver exactly that if they know they are trusted. Here are two stories that demonstrate the value of trust. One that reflects what happens when there is no trust, and another that reflects the tremendous performance and learning that comes when there is trust.
When no trust exists.
This story occurred around 1993. I had just completed attendance at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. This senior-level schooling brings together the best of senior lieutenant colonels and colonels, along with other services and foreign officers from around the world, to study the operational and strategic art of war, with a sprinkling of diplomacy so warriors know there are other tools in their toolbox besides just lethal means. During that year, I found out I would return to Germany after graduation. It would be to one of the premier jobs for a former lieutenant colonel commander, operations officer for one of the Army's 12 divisions, three of which were based in Germany. Unfortunately, I learned during our year at Carlisle that one of them, the 8th Infantry Division, would be disbanded, the one I had been selected for. I eventually ended up in Würzburg, Germany, as the operations officer for the 3rd Infantry Division. Major General Rich Keller was the commanding general and hired me sight unseen, mostly on the recommendation of senior officers such as Monty Meigs and Tom Montgomery, both of whom I had worked for previously. This became the toughest job I ever had up to that point. Having served two tours in Germany, all in Bavaria, I thought I was familiar with the way things were done. I was in my element, but my plates was overflowing. I had to deal with war planning, major field exercises, and large training events in two separate locations in Germany, as well as the day-to-day operations of the division. I had many 18-hour days, more than a few nights where I just crashed on a couch in the office, and some long stretches in the field. The eye-opening experience related to trust that I had during this time was when I led a military-to-military exchange trip to Hungary, one of the satellite countries of the former Soviet Union. The Cold War had ended, and we were now opening the aperture to Eastern European countries that had been coerced into the Warsaw Pact decades earlier by the strong arm of Russia. After the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, General George Jalwin, the supreme Allied commander of the military forces in Europe, established a program called Partnership for Peace, or PFP. His idea was to conduct military-to-military exchanges, reaching across the former Iron Curtain, so new relationships could be forged between the U.S. and its former foes. The goal
was to pull the Warsaw Pact nations out of Russia's sphere of influence and into ours. My trip was the first such effort the U.S. military did with Hungary, and I was able to witness the difference in approaches to trust between the U.S. military and the Eastern European military, and, by extension, the Russians, since Soviet satellite countries' military dogma mirrored the mothership. The Hungarians were truly trying to impress us when they showed us their weaponry, but they were seemingly unaware that the decades-old equipment they had was far inferior to ours, if they had to face us in war. The Russians had given frontline nations in Eastern Europe the oldest and least capable equipment, saving the best for themselves. Soviet satellite countries such as Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and East Germany, that were rolled into the Soviet arc after World War II, were frankly viewed as cannon fodder by the Russians. Although I was only a lieutenant colonel at the time, I was treated like a general. Everywhere I turned, only officers, majors and above, were briefing us. They had little trust in their more junior officers and sergeants, like the U.S. places in our junior leaders. Russian influence was everywhere, and the lack of trust and regimentation contrasted sharply with the way the U.S. military operates, where mission orders are issued along with the commander's intent, thereby giving subordinates the freedom to operate within that framework. In the U.S. military, it's all about trust and empowerment. I saw little of that in Hungary. The Hungarians put up me and my team in a lakeside resort reserved for senior military officials. I remember walking into my dacha and thinking I had just taken a step back in time. Everything in that cottage was 1950s era, from the lights to the handle on the refrigerator door. A few months later, we reciprocated by bringing senior military leaders from Hungary to our bases in Germany. Most of these delegations consisted of colonels and generals. They were shocked when we turned them over to our sergeants, who actually gave the briefings, and even more shocked when we let them mingle with our troops, out of our earshot, to see what U.S. soldiers were really like. General Jowen's approach obviously worked, as a number of former Soviet Union countries are now members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, the Czech Republic, Poland, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, and Montenegro. And yes, Hungary.
When trust exists.
I eventually found myself on the list for both colonel and command. My boss called me in one day and told me that he had both good and bad news. The good news was that I was now the proud owner of a golf course. The bad news was that I was now the proud owner of a golf course. He was telling me that I had been selected to command an army base rather than what I had spent 20 years preparing for, an armored brigade. In fact, it was the base we were on, the 98th Area Support Group, ASG, headquartered right there in Würzburg, Germany. I recall thinking at the time, there must be some mistake. I don't know anything about running a base, and quite frankly, I'm not interested in learning. It took me just a few months to realize this turn of events was the best thing that ever happened to me, professionally. I learned more about trusting the people below me than I ever would have had I continued on the traditional army path. Over 95% of my 3,000-person workforce was civilian. Half were females. An equal number were German nationals. I was like a town mayor, serving more than 45,000 constituents and customers. My leadership style needed to adapt to this very different environment, or I would fail. I was joining their team and needed to learn quickly how to adapt to their environment. I pulled out my philosophy of command, see Appendix A, from my time at Fort Knox and retooled it to target a very different kind of audience. I found that commanding a base, something I had no experience with, required me to put trust, faith, and confidence in a workforce that knew much more about the tasks at hand than I did.
I had to lead the team, but at the same time, I had to have confidence that their shared feedback and advice to me was of value. They needed to know that I trusted them. The leadership skills I employed at that time had little to do with the technical aspects of running an army base, but rather those that required skills at simply leading people, something I had spent 20 years honing. I found myself praising and encouraging what was working well, and just as importantly, I sought to learn from myself what was not working well and how we could make it better. It wasn't difficult sorting out the two, as all I had to do was pay attention to the constituents of my community, those on the receiving end of what we provided. Simply put, I listened to my customers. They could be very vocal when something wasn't right. I understood this well, since I too had been a customer of the community for the previous 18 months. This experience helped me grow as a leader and prepared me for the rest of my time in uniform and beyond. My career and my life were positively shaped by this turn of events. Frankly, I'm not sure I would have seen the success that I experienced thereafter had I not taken this road less traveled, something I didn't initially embrace at the time. Be careful what you wish for. It should be intuitive to most leaders that the higher you climb up the corporate ladder, the greater the reliance you must have on those below you. Support your team and let them do their job, and you'll be amazed at what they give back. Finally, senior leaders must be an organization's biggest cheerleader. I tell this to newly selected generals, but it also applies to the corporate world. Inspire people to be their best and praise them when they deliver. Foster a climate where people want to come to work because of your inspirational leadership. Place trust in them, and you will be surprised at the positive returns on that investment. That's what I tried to do in the 98th ASG, and it worked.
Chapter 3. Are you my mentor?
The greatest good you can do for another is not just to share your riches, but to reveal to him his own. Benjamin Disraeli. When I met with Major Montgomery in Washington, D.C., on my way to Germany in the summer of 1977, I never expected that he would become my first true mentor. There was no contractual agreements or even a discussion about such a relationship. And through all these years, I've never mentioned the word mentor to him. But throughout our relationship, our conversations have given me volumes of knowledge about leadership and a host of other topics. I saw him in a leadership style similar to my own, just more seasoned. I wanted to learn as much as I could from him and use similar techniques as my own leadership responsibilities grew. He helped me get certain jobs, and I worked directly for him once. We remain great friends to this day. Receiving mentorship is a vital element in learning about leadership, and being a mentor is a responsibility of all great leaders. I believe there are four types of mentors: assigned, self-appointed, sought after, and what I call virtual. I have experienced all four. The first three are rather self-evident in terms of what they mean. What I found the most valuable, however, is this last one, virtual. What do I mean? Virtual mentorship is something you do on your own. You simply pay attention to all the people around you and learn from them. This can apply to both your professional and personal life. Pay attention to what others do or say that is particularly smart or good. Then adopt it as your own habit. Notice also, when a leader does something incredibly dumb or harmful to others, then put that in your leadership reservoir as well, so that you will never do the same. We've all seen good and bad behavior and said to ourselves, if I ever get into that position, I hope I behave, or do not behave, like that. Think of your life as a journey carrying a backpack, and observed behaviors are rocks you find along the path. Pick up both the good and bad. The good for future use, and the bad to remind you not to repeat what those rocks represent. I've got plenty of rocks in my backpack, of both kinds.
that I've picked up along my life's journey. All great leaders learn something from those they encounter along their journey. It's also a good practice to acknowledge those who provided meaningful lessons. I regularly cite those who taught me something that I now use myself. I also store away lessons that I want to avoid from leaders who I don't want to emulate, though I generally refrain from naming them. Perhaps one of the greatest periods during which I learned from others was my time in the Pentagon in the late 1990s. My 23 years of service to that point had been exclusively within Army ranks, with no duty served in another military branch. But in 1996, when I became a new Brigadier General, I was assigned to the Joint Staff in the Pentagon. I served during this time with a number of great military leaders who influenced me. Lieutenant General Pete Pace, later Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, was the J3 of the Joint Staff. I had to brief him each morning. My immediate supervisor was first Major General John Van Alstyne, then, later, Rear Admiral Tim Keating, who eventually became the Pacific Command Commander and Northern Command Commander as a 4-star Admiral. Brigadier General Jim Conway, later Commandant of the Marine Corps, was a fellow 1-star, and Colonel David Petraeus was the Executive Officer for the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton. Lieutenant Colonel Terry Guts Robling served there as well, and would later become my boss as a 3-star general when he commanded Marine Corps Forces Pacific, and I was his civilian executive director. That was a particularly interesting relationship, as he was a lieutenant colonel when I was a brigadier general in 1996. While he didn't report to me, we knew each other and occasionally worked together. 17 years later, I reported to him. I remember our first discussion in his office in 2013, where I made clear that while we had a different relationship in the Pentagon, I was perfectly fine working for him. I remember him saying he was as well. He was very comfortable in his own skin. We got along great in the 2 years of his command tenure and remain good friends to this day. Good leaders don't patent their behavior. They willingly pass it on. I have borrowed many leadership techniques, perhaps most of them, from others who freely gave them up, and from some who didn't even know I took them. Let your greatest legacy be that you pass on the best of breed leadership traits you've learned from others. I freely pass on mine. Many are in this book.
Chapter 4. Delivering Under Pressure.
No pressure? No diamonds. Thomas Carlyle. Serving in Germany in the late 1970s was no picnic. The U.S. had just come off a very unpopular war in Vietnam, transitioned the military to an all-volunteer force, and lowered our recruiting standards to keep the number of new enlistees up. Carter administration cuts to the defense budget hurt both readiness and modernization, and the lower induction standards brought in some recruits who didn't represent the best of America. I was assigned to a tank battalion in Erlangen, Germany, in 1977. Initially, as the assistant operations officer, a standard staff job for a newly minted captain waiting for command of a company. About 6 months into this job, my boss was fired and I replaced him. But without an assistant to replace the now vacant position I had just left. The next few months were a blur of activity. My tank battalion participated in major field exercises, gunnery training, and war planning. Eventually, a major came into the battalion to replace me, and I was able to move on to command a tank company, the most coveted job for any Army captain. My work during this period had both highs and lows. Because of the lower quality of recruits during the late 70s, there were major drug problems across the force, including in Germany. I put my executive officer, second in command, in Fort Leavenworth's prison for dealing drugs. And I discharged a number of soldiers associated with drugs or other misconduct. This period was the height of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. So each winter,
the U.S. military conducted a major training exercise called Return of Forces to Germany, Reforger. It was designed to demonstrate to the Soviets that we could quickly mobilize forces and return them.